Hey, good morning. My name is Jeremiah. I'm one of the pastors here at Westbridge. It's awesome to have you here with us this morning. Merry Christmas. It's that time of year, right? And let me say hello to those of you in our parent viewing area as well. Thanks for joining us there. That's a great option if you have small children that you prefer to keep with you during the service. And it's that time of the year, isn't it? We're getting into the Christmas season. As the song says, it's the most wonderful time of the year. How many of you are deep in the throes of Christmas shopping? Anybody? Anybody get any sweet deals? Black Friday? How about Cyber Monday? Or Cyber Tuesday? Cyber Wednesday? Yeah, it just goes on and on, right? Or my wife and I have been talking about, you know, Christmas coming up, and what do we get for the kids? And I think it occurred to me this last week that my kids, I sort of feel bad, they're growing up in the lamest generation of all time, because I grew up in the 80s, and we had some sweet stuff in the 80s. We had Rock'em Sock'em Robots, we had Hungry Hungry Hippo, we had Light Bright, are you kidding me? Light Bright was amazing. Star Wars, the originals. 80s, G.I. Joe, single greatest recruitment tool for the U.S. military in history. And then I remember growing up, we had an Atari 2600, one of the greatest gaming consoles ever. And kids today just can't appreciate how amazing an Atari was, because they're going from one gaming console to the next, so it's just an update in consoles. But when you go, when you go from Pong to Space Invaders, like, kids just can't appreciate the jump in technology that is. And so I know some of you grew up even before that. Some of you grew up in the 70s, and you were sporting your leisure suits and your bell bottoms and listening to the Bee Gees and enjoying the first of many, many Rocky movies. And then some of you even grew up before that. You grew up in the 60s, and you were fluffing your afro and listening to the Beatles and just watching your lava lamp. And some of you grew up in the 50s, and we are just so glad you're still with us today. The crazy thing is, some of you are adults, and you grew up in the 90s. That is crazy to me. And it's hard for me to believe that. My kids love to tease me and my wife and ask us questions about what life was like in the olden days back in the 1900s. That's how they like to phrase that. So, but Christmas is one of the most exciting times of the year, right? For my kids. And you know why. You know why they get excited about Christmas, right? Anybody, shout it out if you know why. No, Jesus. Come on. I don't know what's going on at your house, but yeah, presents, right? And for some people, they get excited during this time of year because it's all about the music. Right? And they just like love Christmas music. They can't wait till they can start listening to it. And just, some of you may not know this, but you are actually not allowed to listen to Christmas music until after Thanksgiving. And then you're only allowed to listen to it till January 1st. That's in the Bible. So if you're listening to it longer than that, you need help. For others of you, it's all about the food. Right, because it's during the holidays that certain desserts just appear that you don't see any other time of year. And you're like, oh, that's interesting. I mean, it only comes around once a year. It's the most wonderful time of the year. And basically what happens is we try to eat healthy. And then at Thanksgiving, we kind of give up. And then we're like, well, there's only 6 weeks till New Year's, you know. So, and we just convince ourselves I'll start again January 1st, which that's my plan every year. And the ironic part is I'm working, like, really hard to get six-pack abs. That's, like, my goal for the New Year. And I'm frustrated with it because it feels like no matter how many six-packs I drink, it's not happening. So, but I think it's difficult for us. In 2017, right, we're heading into 2018, that's crazy. And if you think about everything that goes on during this time of the year, if you think about all the Christmas baking and the decorating and the music and the shopping and the family parties and the work parties and the functions and all the different things that go on during this time of year, through all the hustle and all the bustle and all the activity, sometimes what happens is that the meaning of Christmas, and while we never totally lose sight of it, it's not like we're just 100% consumed with the this American mindset of like getting out there and just enjoying Christmas. But I think for some of us, we go, yeah, it's about, we know there's an underlying theme to it, and we know that there's a meaning to it. And we acknowledge that, but I think oftentimes in everything that goes on during this time of year, that can get a little bit lost, or it can become a little bit like white noise to us. It kind of, yeah, it's there, it's sitting in the background, and we get it, and we understand it, but it's like, you know, pass the fudge. And so in light of that, I think it's worth asking the question, what is Christmas really all about? And while we know the answer, I think it's important for us to at least take some time to pause and reflect on that and really let it impact our hearts. And so to fully appreciate Christmas, we must understand its history. For literally hundreds and hundreds of years, a group of people were waiting for some good news. They were waiting for some very particular good news. It was a promise that had been passed down from generation to generation. And it was a promise that God had made specifically to the nation of Israel, saying that through them the whole world would be blessed, saying that at a certain point in human history, one would come to them who would be a light in the darkness, and who would set them free, who would rescue them. And yet entire generations came and went without seeing the fulfillment of that promise. And so we pick up really the Christmas story in a little town called Bethlehem. It's kind of a dumpy, rural, hick town. It's kind of like, you know, the number one sport in Bethlehem is NASCAR, and the number one dinner is a Hot Pocket. And basically, in this town, you know, the women enjoy chewing tobacco, and the men enjoy a good mullet. And the most exciting thing that's happened to Bethlehem in the last 25 years is the opening of the new Walmart. And so it's into this environment, really. It's this humble town. And yet here is this quiet night. There were some shepherds out watching their sheep, and they're kind of on third shift. You know, they're doing the overnight shift, and some angels show up. And Luke actually records for us what they say. And the angel makes this declaration to these shepherds who are working this overnight shift. And here's what he says in Luke chapter 2. The angel says this: I bring you good news that will bring great joy to all people. I bring you good news. It will bring great joy to all people. Good news, something we could all use a little more of. Not only that, he said, this good news is going to bring great joy, and not just to you, to all people, everywhere, for all time. This good news was the fulfillment of a long-awaited promise from God. It was the fulfillment of one who was coming, who had been promised. God said, I'm going to send someone to come and rescue you, and through that person, the whole world is actually going to be blessed. As we approach the season, we often call this season Advent. But here's what that means. The term Advent means arrival. When we say we're celebrating Advent, what we're acknowledging is that we are celebrating the arrival of someone. One of the hymns or ancient songs that gets sung most often during this holiday season is called O Come, Emmanuel. The lyrics of that song are written specifically about this time in history and about this nation in history, Israel. And the lyrics, if you ever listen to these lyrics, it says this: O come, Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel. And what that means is that the nation of Israel is actually a captive nation. The Roman Empire has conquered them, and they serve the Roman Empire. And they're waiting for this promised one to come and set them free. And so this song is written about the nation of Israel in this time in history. O come, Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel, that mourns in lowly exile here until the Son of God appear. O come, thou dayspring, come and cheer our spirits by thine advent here. Cheer our spirits by your arrival. And so Christmas, or Advent, is literally the celebration of an arrival. It's an arrival that was promised hundreds of years earlier by the prophet Isaiah, who wrote this: the Lord himself will give you the sign. Look, the virgin will conceive a child. She will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel, which means God is with us. This is an amazing promise. But here's the problem. Sometimes it feels like God is not with us. Sometimes life throws us some curveballs. Sometimes things happen, and sometimes we make decisions, and God feels distant. And God feels far away. And we wonder, God, are you there? God, are you with us? Are you indeed active in the everyday lives of everyday people? Or is this an idea that sounds good on the surface, but is really just something that's meant to help me cope with life? Is this like some kind of cosmic coping mechanism, or are you really there? And sometimes God feels distant, and that was certainly the case for the nation of Israel. By the time the angels visit with this good news, there have been 400 years of silence from God. 400 years with no recorded word from God. No prophet has spoken. No one has brought the word from God to the people in over 400 years. And as far as we know, they are waiting and they're waiting and they're waiting and they're passing on this promise and this hope that this arrival of this promised one is going to happen. And generations come and generations go and God is silent. And the people who lived during the era of Mary and Joseph are wondering if this promise of God is ever going to come true. And they're thinking, maybe God has forgotten us. Maybe God is consumed with so many other things. Maybe God is angry with us, or maybe God is just too distant. He doesn't hear us. And you can imagine how difficult this must have been for Mary and Joseph themselves. They have this promise from angels. They show up and say, you're gonna give birth to a son, call him Emmanuel. But beyond that, everything seemed not only ordinary, but really difficult. They had to travel, Luke tells us they had to travel 80 miles to Bethlehem when Mary was 9 months pregnant and she rode on a donkey. For 80 miles, 9 months pregnant. When my wife was 9 months pregnant, she had to stop to pee 3 times on the way to Coburn's. And she was riding in a Honda. And then you got to think about Joseph, because you know at the end of this, it somehow is going to all end up being his fault. I've been down this road before, right? So I've done this 4 times, and I know how difficult it can be, all the cravings, all the inconvenience, all the pain, and then, of course, everything my wife went through as well. And to fully understand just how long they had been waiting for God with us, you have to start back at the beginning. So here's the story of Advent. It begins much further back. Number one, God created us to exist in loving community with himself. Now, think about this. Jesus not only taught that we were created to have a relationship with God, but Jesus said this is a relationship that is characterized by love. That's extraordinary. Jesus says this is not a relationship that's characterized by fear or by anger or by distance. He says this is a relationship that is characterized by love. Jesus indicated that we can have a relationship with God, creator of the universe, that is marked by love. He taught things like love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. He said things like God so loved the world. So when you think about that, in the beginning, the author of the creation story tells us that infinite, eternal, loving God set everything in motion. He set the cosmos into motion, and he created out of nothing everything that we see and hear and touch and encounter with our senses. He created everything. He created this universe of perfection and beauty and love because God is love. And then God determined to share his love. Because love really isn't love unless you're giving it away, unless you're sharing it with someone. Love is not an emotion, it's something that you do, right? And so in order to share love, God creates human beings to share love with, and he did so by creating the first man and woman, and he was God with us. And the creation story tells us that God walked with humanity, that there was this loving interaction. There was this interconnectivity and communion with God, the creator of the universe. In Genesis chapter 1, it says, God said, let us make human beings in our image to be like us And so God created human beings in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. And then God looked over all he had made, and he saw that it was very good. Now, if you've never heard the story, or maybe you're just a little familiar with the story of Adam and Eve, the story of creation as written in the scriptures, for most of us, if you've ever heard the story, what most of us kind of know about the story is that, like, all right, God created Adam and Eve, and then they ate an apple, and they messed everything up. The end. And that's basically what a lot of people know, and I think that oftentimes we miss the significance of what's going on in the creation story. See, God says, okay, there is this one tree. You can eat from any tree in the garden, but there is this one tree that you're forbidden to eat from. And if you eat from this tree, it will bring death. And this tree really serves two functions by way of declaration. Number one, it's a declaration of human free will. You have the opportunity, you have the ability to go ahead and eat from that tree if you want to. God's saying, don't, but I'm not going to restrict it. You could if you wanted. In order for real love to exist, we have to have the opportunity to reject love. If you're forced to love someone, then it's not real love at all. It's a pre-programmed response. And so this tree serves as a way for, this is a way of God saying, hey, you are free to go your own way if you decide to. And then secondly, it's a declaration of the limit of Adam and Eve's authority. They were the stewards, and he is the creator. This is a reminder that they are created beings and God is the creator. And so when they ate the fruit, they were ultimately rejecting God's authority over them and declaring their independence from him. And of all of the creation of God, the only thing that God had not placed under their authority was himself. And that arrangement wasn't good enough for them. And so they rebelled and they traded their favor with God to pursue their own pleasure. And it wasn't like they didn't just stumble across it, right? They weren't aware of where that fruit came from. Like, oh, that's a really delicious apple. Oh, no. Forgot about that tree. They knew exactly what they were doing. And they chose to go in the exact opposite direction of God's plan for their life. And this is the condition that we find ourselves in as broken humanity. Regardless of what you believe about the Bible, regardless of if you use the Bible to help point you to Jesus or if it's something that you grew up with, here's what we all know about human morality. Regardless of if you're a follower of Jesus or some other religion or no religion at all, what we all agree on when it comes to human morality is that there are some things that we should do and there are some things we shouldn't do, and that whatever that standard is that we set for ourselves, we oftentimes break our own standard. That's something that we can all agree on. The Bible just calls that sin. And here's what we've discovered. Number two, sin began when we were convinced God couldn't be trusted. This interaction between God and humans had nothing to do with trees and fruit. This is God's way of saying, I've put everything under your authority except for me. And you have the ability to obey me as the only authority over you, or you have the ability to reject my authority in your life and go your own way. And in this account, in Genesis chapter 3, in this account of creation, we learn that the accuser comes in the form of a serpent and begins to attack God's character, begins to cast down, particularly in the mind of Eve, that God could actually be trusted. He says, really? God really said it would bring death? He said you would die? You won't die. The accuser says this, God knows that your eyes will be opened as soon as you eat it, and you will be like God, knowing both good and evil. And the woman was convinced. The accuser shows up and convinces them that God cannot be trusted. He can't be trusted, that God's actually holding out on them, because God knows that if they eat this specific fruit, they will become just like God. They will become powerful and all-knowing like God. And so the accuser is able to convince them that somehow they're missing out, that God's holding out on them. One theologian I was reading said that the sins that you and I tend to struggle with, the things that we deal with, lust, greed, pride, envy, selfishness, hatred, these are really just symptoms of this one bigger sin that really plagues us, our lack of trust in God. That if we would simply trust that God is who he says he is, that he will do what he promises to do, that many of these other things that we deal with would be minimized or go away. But when we mischaracterize God, when we paint a picture of God where we make him out to be this creator who is selfishly holding out on us, then it leaves us with no other option than to try to pursue our own way of living life. And you know why this story of Adam and Eve is so compelling? It's because the story of Adam and Eve is really the story of you, and it's the story of me. This is your story, this is my story. Every single one of us have struggled with the same thing that Adam and Eve struggled with. We were given free will, and somewhere along the way, we decided through our choices, through our actions, we decided God couldn't be trusted, that we were missing out, that there must be a better way. And so all of us, at some point in life, reject God's authority and declare our independence from him and say, okay, I'm going to live life my own way. And here's what we discover. Number three, sin always comes prepackaged with a penalty. Here's what you and I know. Here's what our own experiences confirm. Is that every time that we reject God's authority in favor of living life our own way, what we're saying is this: I have the freedom. God, I have the freedom to do what I want to do. And we go live in a way that's contrary to what God wants us to do, thinking freedom, freedom, freedom. And here's what our own experiences confirm: that often leaves us more imprisoned. It often leaves us not more free, but more imprisoned. It often leaves us not more whole, but more broken. Every time you sin, something dies. Sin kills things. Sin is destructive. Sin separates. That's why the Apostle Paul writes this in his letter to the Romans. He says, in the past you were slaves to sin, and you didn't even think about doing right. You did evil things, and now you're ashamed of what you did. Did those things help you? No, they only brought death. You initially did these things. You declared your freedom from God and said, I'm living life my own way. And he says, and now you look back at those things and you wish you hadn't done those things. You're ashamed. Did those things help you? And you acknowledge, no, they actually only brought death. Sin kills your conscience. Sin kills your mind. It kills your body. Sin kills your self-respect. Sin damages relationships in your marriage, with your kids, work relationships, relationships with parents. And sin ultimately separates us from God because we're declaring our independence from God. I don't need your authority in my life. I can live life myself. Immediately, what's interesting in this story, immediately after Adam and Eve chose to declare their independence from God, they were ashamed. The account, the creation account tells us they immediately felt ashamed and that they hid from God. That they decided we better run away, we better hide, because we're not sure how God is going to react now. And folks, we have been hiding from God and hiding from each other ever since. We reject God's authority in pursuit of our own pleasure, and we end up feeling broken and restless. And no one has to teach us that that's the reaction. Yesterday, I was with my two boys at home. My wife took our daughters, and they were doing some Christmas shopping and some other activities. And so I was home. I left the room for probably 90 seconds. And I came back, and there was a Costco-size jug of cashews just been purchased that was flipped upside down and emptied all over the floor. And I turned the corner, and I'm like, whoa, I just, what? Ugh! Like that, something like that. And I'm like, what is going on? And my three-year-old Liam was like, and I could tell, like, he did not want to move towards me. He wanted to move away from me. And he had this, like, sort of, like, smile on. And I was like, Liam, what did you do? And he's like, I said, come here. And he's like, I said, come here. No. And isn't it interesting, even at 3 years old, you don't have to, he knew he shouldn't have done it, and you don't have to teach him to hide or to be distant. He just knew automatically, like, don't go near Dad. And I have no history of, like, beating him or anything like that, you know? I have no history. Like, I just, like, come here. Come talk to me. Why'd you do this? Mm-mm. Didn't want to come close. So finally, I said, come here. Let's pick this up. We got to pick this up. What were you thinking? And he goes, this is dog food for my puppies. Now, we don't have puppies, by the way. I said, oh, I mean, how do you argue with that logic, really, when it comes down to it? But I thought to myself, as parents of four kids, what we have learned is that it's not the racket in the house that you have to be concerned with, it's the silence. You're like, whoa, it is way too quiet in here. Something's going down, you know? Especially when kids are younger, right? It's like, okay, where's my three-year-old? Okay, if I can't hear him or see him, he's like taking a doozy of a toozy in a corner somewhere, or he's like camped out in the pantry with the door shut, just destroying an entire bag of Oreos or something, you know? Either way, he does not want to be found. He's like, I'm ashamed, I gotta hide. And isn't it interesting that that is our immediate reaction? When we feel like we have disappointed whoever is in charge, our reaction is, I feel ashamed, I want to hide. Where does that come from? It doesn't come from God. We find that in our own hearts, not in the heart of God. And so this dynamic is present. Isaiah actually said it like this in Isaiah 59. He writes this, it's your sins that have cut you off from God. Your sins have cut you off. And what's interesting is we make the decision to say, God, I'm removing myself from your authority. I'm declaring my independence. And we go off on our own. And then when we find ourselves broken and restless and imprisoned, we go, God, where are you? And oftentimes it's not because God is distant. It's because we've moved away from God. And we discover that it's our sins that separates, sin destroys that relational connection. See, you were created by God and for God. And until you acknowledge that and until you understand that, life is never really going to make sense. It's going to be one continual pursuit and endeavor after another. But until you just acknowledge my purpose for being, I was created by God and for God. And until you acknowledge that, life is never going to make sense. You need, and I need, connection and community with a loving God. It's why we exist. We need it like we need air, like we need water. And you were made to have this right relationship with God, to have a community and interconnectivity with your Creator. And so we sense when that is amiss. And here's what we do. Number four, humanity tried in vain to reunite with God. Do you want to know why there's so many stories, not only in the first two-thirds of the Bible that deal with the history of the nation of Israel, and there's a lot of violence in there. And do you want to know why there's also so much violence just in human history outside of the Bible? Just in nation after nation after nation, in empire after empire after empire. Do you know why there's so much violence and bloodshed and so much chasing and ambition? We're trying to figure out how to fix this. We're trying to figure out how do we fix what is amiss between us and God. And so in our own hearts, we've tried hiding, and now we try all these other things. We pursue things to medicate what's wrong, the distance between us and God. And so we conquer, and we capture, and we kill, and we think we can solve it through bloodshed. If we conquer enough territory, if we become powerful enough, if we become wealthy enough, if we become influential enough or famous enough, if we acquire enough possessions, if we have enough highs, enough experiences in life. And so what do? Throughout human history, what do human beings do? We do everything we can to medicate the restlessness in our souls. We've declared our independence from God. We're living life our own way, and we recognize that's led us now to imprisonment and brokenness and restlessness. So now, how do we fix that? And so we try all these avenues. So we're looking for the next promotion, the next sexual experience, the next drink, the next meal, the next party, right? The next high, the next paycheck, maybe even the next intellectual or religious or spiritual experience. And we're trying to just go from one to the next, and if we can just get enough of those things right, then maybe it will somehow medicate that brokenness, that restlessness that we feel inside. But it never ultimately satisfies, because you and I were designed for something else. And none of that stuff will fill the restlessness in our soul. Friends, you will never experience the peace that your heart longs for apart from community and connectivity with God, because it is why you were created. It is why I was created. And so this story, this advent, this arrival is the story of God in his great love setting in motion a plan that we might be able to fully embrace connection and community with God through the person of Jesus. See, number five, Jesus came to earth to restore relationship. If you've never heard this before, or if you've never heard it put this way before, then I want you to hear it right here and right now. God has never stopped moving in your direction. And God has never for one single second stopped pursuing you. God has never for one single second stopped loving you. And even when you've declared your independence from God and live life your own way, even when you feel ashamed for doing that and you feel like you're hiding from God, even when you feel like God seems, you know, you wonder, is God angry? Is God, should I fear him? Is he distant? God has never stopped moving in your direction. It reminds me of this painting by Michelangelo, not the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle, but the Renaissance artist. And he painted this picture in 1508, and it took him 4 years to complete. Check this out. Now, this painting, we've cropped the painting a little bit to keep some of the more artistic parts of this sort of off the screen for today. I think he had a firm grasp of human anatomy. So, but what you notice about this painting is that God seems to be contorted and twisted, and he's reaching out for Adam. He's reaching out for Adam represents humanity. He's reaching out to connect with human beings, and he's reaching, and he's kind of twisting, and he's got his body contorted, and he's doing everything he can to reach to Adam. And Adam is kind of laying back on the pillow, and he's like, eh. He's kind of indifferent. He's kind of got one eye on the game, you know. And he can't pull himself away to be bothered with connecting with God, right? And Michelangelo is communicating God's determination to reach out and exist in loving community with who he has created. Man is being offered life with God. One art critic wrote this about this piece: all of man's potential, physical and spiritual, is contained in this one timeless moment. Man is being offered a life in connection with God. And God is doing everything he can, short of grabbing his finger, to connect with him. And Adam is indifferent. Maybe he's blind to just how far God is reaching. God is as close as he can be, but having come that close, he allows just a little space, and he waits for Adam to just lift a finger and move one small step back towards him. And all Adam has to do is lift his finger, but he's apparently too indifferent or too blind to God's activity to realize all that God is doing to connect with him. And if I'm honest, if I'm truly honest, I often do the same thing. God is moving in my direction, and he wants to be active in my life. And oftentimes, I'm too busy. I'm too indifferent. I'm blinded to his activity in my life. John, who is one of Jesus' closest friends during his time on earth, wrote this about him. He says, "No one has ever seen God, but the unique one, Jesus, who is himself God, is near to the Father's heart. He has revealed God to us." He has revealed God to us. Jesus has revealed God to us. His name is Emmanuel. God is with us. And so John says this. He says, listen, I know that this concept of God is hard for us, and sometimes, especially in the era that we live in, it's been hundreds of years since we feel God has spoken to us. But if you've ever wondered what God is like, or what, beyond just the concept of God, look to Jesus. He says, Jesus, this unique one who comes from God. He's close to God's heart, and he reveals to us what God is like. The Apostle Paul wrote about this as well in several of his letters. In his letter to the Colossians, he writes this: "Don't let anyone capture you with empty philosophies and high-sounding nonsense that comes from human thinking or from the spiritual powers of this world rather than from Christ. For in Jesus lives all the fullness of God in a human body." In the same letter, Paul writes this: "Christ is the visible image of the invisible God." Paul says this: if you want to know, if you've ever wondered what God is like, maybe you've thought God is something to be feared. Maybe you've thought God is angry. Maybe you thought God is indifferent. He's just distant, and he's out of touch with everyday people. If you ever wonder what is God like, in Jesus is found the fullness of God in a human body. Jesus is the physical representation, the physical, visible image of an invisible God. And here's what we find in Jesus. We find in Jesus never someone who is indifferent, someone who is causing pain, someone who is hurting to teach a lesson. What we find in Jesus is someone who always only stands in opposition to evil, who stands in opposition to diseases. We only ever find Jesus healing diseases, not causing them, standing in fierce opposition to death, not causing death. As a matter of fact, we never even find Jesus causing storms. We only find him calming them. And then we find Jesus loving the unlovable and interacting with those society deems as the outcasts. We find Jesus teaching a self-sacrificing enemy love. He says things like, don't just love people who love you back. Real love is found when you love people who are hard to love, people who don't love you back, people who may even want to harm you. But when you instead pray for their well-being, that's a God kind of love. And then Jesus not only taught that, he modeled it. The Apostle Paul writes this about Jesus again in his letter to the Galatians. He says, when the right time came, God sent his son, born of a woman, subject to the law. God sent him to buy freedom for us who were slaves to the law so that he could adopt us as his very own children. Paul says this, remember how you're a slave? Remember how you declared your independence from God and you thought, now I'm free, I can live life my own way? And remember how that so-called freedom actually left you feeling more imprisoned? Well, at the right time in human history, Paul says, God sent Jesus into the world. He sent his son, born of a woman, subject to the law. And yet, he sets us free from those things that have imprisoned us. And now, he's invited us to be a part of his family. And folks, the entire message of Christmas, the whole message of this Advent, this arrival, is that there is no depth that your Creator will not descend to for you. That there is no place of messiness that God will not meet you in order to restore relationship with you, and that there is no distance that God will not travel in order to show you how much he loves you. I love the song that we sang today. Emmanuel, God is with us. Your heart won't stop coming after me. And I could hide, but your heart won't stop coming after me. And some of you are here today simply to hear that. Because Christmas reminds us that God is closer than we think. See, often when it feels like God is distant, it's not because God has moved away, it's because I have. It's because I've declared my independence from God. I've said, God, I'm living life my own way. I know you have asked me to live life this way, but I feel like you can't be, I feel like you're holding out on me. So I'm gonna live life my own way. And when I do, I find myself going, man, God feels really distant. But if I'm honest, the reality is that God hasn't moved a muscle away from me. He's only ever moving towards me. And if there is a distance between myself and God, it's because I've moved away from God. When Jesus came to earth, he wanted to make sure that we would always know and never wonder that God isn't just close. God is with us.